Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of MPMA's Bug Bites. I'm one of your co-hosts for the show, Mike Bentley, and I'm joined with my other co-hosts,
Ellie Lane
and Laura Rosenwald.
There it is. Off to a great.
I normally don't see the "and" part, and I got really upset real fast.
Mike said "and."
I know. I think I forgot that we usually say "and," just in case you guys forget after a couple episodes how this usually goes. This is good. In case anybody out there that may or may not be listening is wondering, this is about as professional as it gets on the show. So, all right. Joined with our co-hosts, Ellie Lane and Laura Rosenwald. We're really, really excited to be joined today by our special guest, Jen McCauley. She's the marketing director for McCauley Pest Services out of Bryant, Arkansas. Jen, thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
So we tried to explain to Jen before we started recording what she can and cannot expect. I don't think she expected us to mess up the intro. So Jen, if this doesn't set the tone for what the rest of this episode could be, then I don't know what else will. So
okay, I'm here for it. I have no expectations.
Oh, that's good. No expectations. Perfect. That's exactly what we're looking for. That's good. Awesome. Well, we really appreciate you, agreeing to be on the show. Before we dive into our nerdy adventure of competition here, where we get to talk to you about some papers that we all found, we've had the chance to get to know you over the years. I know a lot of our listeners probably have also had the chance to get to know you, but just in case anybody out there may not be familiar with you, if you want to talk a little bit about the company you're with, where you guys are located, and I know that your start in the pest control industry was not with McCauley Pest Services, so if you want to talk about a little bit of that too.
Sure, okay. Jen McCauley. Hey, friends. I work with McCauley Services. My husband, Justin McCauley, is our CEO, and then my brother-in-law, Zach, is our COO, and we're based out of Arkansas. And as Mike mentioned, I did grow up in the industry. So I actually worked in my dad's business at Eden Advanced Pest Technologies on the West Coast over in Washington State. So I grew up in the industry, and I'm super blessed to just have grown up with so many friends and, just this generation of kids growing up together and learning so much about growing businesses and then learning about, some fun pest stuff along the way too. So, Justin and I met because, we've always been involved. Both businesses have been involved in MPMA, and then some other networking groups in the industry. And Justin and I we chaired a committee together, the LDG at the time. And we met at, Academy in Arizona one hot summer, and one thing led to another and here I am. We are on we'll celebrate our 15-year wedding anniversary this year. So I've been in Arkansas for the last 15 years.
That's awesome. Now, you mentioned that you guys met at Academy, and that's one of my favorite Academy stories. And for anybody that's not familiar with the Academy event that we're talking about, it is not like a normal conference. MPMA puts on a lot of events. Academy is... it's hard to describe unless you're actually there. But so you guys met at Academy. Do you want to give like a quick elevator pitch as to what Academy is and maybe how you guys met while you were there? Because you guys were not on the same team, right?
No. There's some stories that could have wrecked the whole relationship, honestly, but survived. So Academy is an awesome opportunity to learn and grow. It's, I'd say it's maybe geared more towards mid-level management, but that's probably not true. Anyone and everyone should attend Academy at some point just because it's such a unique experience. It's like an Olympics on steroids with some cool professional development thrown in there. And I think it allows you this opportunity to be really vulnerable because you're competitive. And, the cool thing about the program is, MPMA and the staff have always found a way to engage anyone at any comfort level. So whether you're like physically, competitive and driven or mentally, you've got an opportunity to show up and engage. It is one of those, you get out what you put in, but you also don't have a lot of room not to participate and engage. So it's really cool. And I think just that kind of, I don't know, raw energy. You stay up late, you're working on stuff with your team. You make a lot of good friends in a different way than you would at, say, I don't know, Legislative Day or Pest World even, because you're just at this different level of commitment and engagement. And, you know, it's also kind of just more, I guess I say raw because you're not, you know, dressed up and putting on airs. You are in your team shirt and you're showing up in the mornings. And if you don't, your team's losing points. So it's really cool experience. And you do learn a lot too. We have great keynote speakers. And you want me to keep going on the Academy soapbox? Or
No, that was perfect. I mean, like I said, I mean, you did a perfect job of explaining it. You know, Academy, what we do as a staff is every attendee, all of our attendees for the conference are split up into six different teams. So when you show up to Academy, you're assigned to a team, and teams are differentiated by colors. So you show up and you get a team jersey, essentially. It's a, you know, color-coded jersey, and then you're thrown into that team. And that team most likely will consist of folks that are not from the company you're associated with. These are folks you may not have ever met in the industry. And you go through about 3 days of a wide range of events, games, challenges. Peppered in there some amazing keynote sessions and some opportunities for leadership development and networking. But it really is a unique, one-of-a-kind of event that, as Jen mentioned, it's, you know, you're dressed in kind of, you know, sports clothes the whole time because you may be outside and, you know, building something. Then you have to come inside and, you know, everybody has to be there on time to get points. And or it may be something that's more of a physical activity. But ultimately, at the end, the teams that win, they're all competing for first, second, and third place. And what you take home as a trophy is about $1. Yeah, one like $1, like little medal first that says first place, second place, or third place. But I will tell you, when you put points associated with stuff, what people are, the level of competition that people bring to the table, whether it's a brain game or it's a physical activity, is insanely intense. And it's super awesome to watch as a spectator. I can't even imagine as a staff member, I'm not allowed to participate. But I know, Jen, that both you and Justin are pretty competitive folks. Mm-hmm. So I can only imagine, I wasn't there at that Academy, but I can only imagine just how intense the competition had to be between the two of you. And the fact that you guys still ended up getting married after that is pretty impressive. So,
yes, I know. I think y'all have done some things, you know, to try to, maybe prevent some of the things from rehappening. But I remember, like, you know, we had like this really cool marketing strategy where you had to put it on a, you know, at that point, the little memory sticks, you know, and he hacked my presentation and deleted it. And I was like, this was so good. We probably would have won. So there's other examples like that where it's fun, you know, it's all fun. But that was a close one. That was,
yeah. As an MPMA staff member, I want to make it clear, we do not nor do we encourage cheating of any
cheating.
But I will tell you, some folks will pull out all the stops to win, including sabotaging other teams, which we strongly advocate against and are not in support of in any way, shape, or form. I can't imagine how many hours your team put into that, particularly you as a marketing expert. Yeah. Probably something you worked very closely on.
You know, so if you're being optimistic, I guess it made me realize, like, cybersecurity, and you can't be too safe, right? So
there you go.
Gotta have a backup.
Also, let my guard down. You know, but to your point, you know, the cheap trophies, they are a family tradition. And if you don't come home with something, so we've got a little drawer just for our Academy medals. So
that's right. That's awesome. I love hearing that. I mean, so, and while we don't get to participate, we have just as much fun putting it together. We've already started the program planning for it, game design, everything else. So, you know, our team works for months to build these things out, it is one of the most fun experiences that I have here working with MPMA, is kind of getting to see all that stuff come to fruition and see everybody competing in every different facet of competition, whether it's, like I said, it's brain games, puzzles, you know, physical activities, those sorts of things. It's a pretty awesome event. So I'm really happy to hear that you guys have enjoyed it. Sorry again for the sabotage again.
It worked out in his favor.
Well, we know what happens.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, look, I know that I could probably go on and on about Academy stuff because it is one of my favorite events of the year. But what we really asked you here for today was to endure a different kind of competition. That is a bit of a brain game here where we get to go through and talk about some stuff. So, Ellie, you want to clue Jen in on what she's about to experience? Maybe any of our listeners that haven't heard an episode before?
Yeah, absolutely. So the main feature of the podcast is our friendly competition. And so if you aren't familiar with the rules of the game and what we're about to subject Jen to, here's a quick summary. So each of us is going to have 5 minutes to review our favorite scientific discovery or news article from the past couple of months. And after each of us finishes our summary, we're going to pause for questions and discussion about the article. And at the end, Jen, you get to pick the winner. And so you get to pick who you thought did the best job covering their article. Now, we do get pretty competitive about this. And so you don't need to tell us the order of the other two, just who got first.
On to me. Okay.
And so last episode, we have the order of the competition of who goes in what order. I won't say who won last episode, so we have a clean slate, nothing interference here.
Okay.
But the order for today, we're gonna have Laura's going to go first, and then Mike's going to go second, and I will go last.
Okay.
So, hey. Laura, if you would like to kick us off.
By all means. Okay. So the mine is a little funny this time around, but I kind of really adore it. This comes out of Osaka University in Japan and Diponegoro University in Indonesia. I am so sorry if I mispronounced that in any way, shape, or form. This came out February 29th, 2024, and this is Arianto et al. 2024. And then the title of my paper this week is Feedback Control of Automatic Navigation for Cyborg Cockroach Without External Motion Capture System. So, we mostly think of cockroaches as a nuisance. They're dirty, hang out in gross things, eat our foods, and can spread disease. But, and perhaps the ultimate villain to hero storyline since the Grinch saved Christmas, what if we could use these ordinary pests as something extraordinary in times of crisis? Enter the cyborg cockroach. Half computer, half roach, this adorable little monstrosity has the potential to be a game changer for search and rescue missions in urban areas. Cockroaches are actually well suited to search and rescue missions, as they are small enough to crawl through small openings and rubble, can self-right themselves if they get overturned, are adept at moving in dark and sheltered places, and are great climbers. Previous studies concerning cockroaches and search and rescue missions mainly focused on using cockroaches as tiny videographers, where cameras were attached to battery-powered backpacks that the cockroaches would wear. However, this method left a lot to be desired, as these systems take up a lot of battery power, require a lot of human input, and don't always provide the best images in darkened areas. In addition, cockroaches tend to stick in one place once they reach an area that they deem appropriate shelter, like a dark corner. Therefore, the purpose of this study was to examine the potential of cyborg cockroaches operating and navigating complex environments on their own, quote unquote, thanks to machine learning. To prevent cockroaches from slacking on their important search and rescue mission jobs, they were each fitted with an individual wireless stimulator backpack. This backpack serves multiple purposes. For one, it acts as a stimulant for the cockroach to keep exploring in disaster zones by stimulating the antennae and the circe. Both are important sensory organs for the cockroaches that help them navigate their worlds. Second, it contains a transmitter that wirelessly sends data that describes the location and movement of the cockroach, which additionally assists the computer in determining where the cockroach should go next. Third, it's fitted with a tiny laser sensor that can help determine the distance of the cockroach to a solid object. Lastly, it's also fitted with a small thermal infrared sensor to detect human body heat. All of this is packed into a backpack that is 0.8 inches long on top of an adult Madagascar hissing cockroach. The researchers conducted experiments where the cyborg cockroaches were asked to navigate difficult areas such as sharp corners and whether they were able to find a human in a complex environment. The cyborg cockroaches were able to navigate sharp corners with a success rate of 82.3%, which is a huge win for a species that generally likes to stay hunkered down in those kinds of areas. The researchers also were able to create a user interface that allowed humans to, quote unquote, take control of the cyborg cockroach and manually operate the cockroach within a complex environment using the laser and infrared sensors. However, most importantly, they were able to successfully conduct a trial where a human was detected in a complex environment by a cyborg cockroach that was completely run on machine learning without any sort of human intervention. This onboard obstacle avoidance packed into the cyborg cockroach backpacks has the potential to be a groundbreaking innovation for search and rescue missions and beyond. While there's a lot of testing that still needs to be done, the fact that a completely automated cockroach was able to successfully find a human in a testing scenario is a great first step for a tool that could be used to save lives. In addition, I think there's a lot of potential with this kind of technology for use in the pest management sphere. Cockroaches often engage in aggregation behavior and like to buddy up together. Think about how easy it would be if you had a cyborg roach who could lead you directly to the source of an infestation so you know exactly where to treat. And while it is entirely possible that we're just creating a new means for cockroaches to take over the world, I think we should at least get started on sewing those tiny little capes for the cyborg roaches who might be the superheroes of our next urban disaster. So.
Thanks, Laura.
I don't know the time on that because my timer didn't start. So
you're fine. You're at like 4:15. You're
fine. Yeah, that was pretty good. Yeah.
I looked over at my screen. I looked over at my screen and just saw 0 seconds. And I was like, what?
Oh, no.
So this episode is just me panicking the entire time. It's fine. Everything's fine.
I thought you did a great job.
Thank you.
Okay. So now, am I supposed to ask questions?
Yeah,
if you want.
Okay. So I guess there was one point where it is a computerized cockroach. It's not a computer backpack on a cockroach, right?
It is a computer. It's okay. A computer backpack that's on a cockroach.
Okay. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I had two thoughts. Like, so when you were saying they found people, I was thinking of Forshaw's safe house program for like human trafficking and trying to help find things. Then there was like, you know what? There's also like this whole other world I don't think we want to see. But to your point, finding a whole pocket of roaches in a, I don't want to see that either, but you're right. It would be very handy.
Yeah.
That was a cool story. Do they have like it was just trial. So are they launching something from that or do we know?
I couldn't quite tell from the study whether or not like what the next step was going to be. I think they were going to try to fine tune because the, you know, it's AI. So, you know, there's always a little bit of like, well, okay.
How much money per unit that costs. So like if somebody stepped on it, like, and they kill, you know, destruction, how much did that cost?
I don't know. I would imagine because there's like 4 or 5 different sensors on those backpacks that it probably costs a surprising amount of money. I mean, granted, you know, at least the Madagascar hissing cockroaches are like $1 at the pet store, but the rest of it's probably pretty expensive.
Okay. Yeah. I'd be curious how durable they're going to make those things. Okay. Cool. Yeah. Good trailer.
So one thing I was wondering about was like, I'm not sure if I just kind of like missed it, but for trying to get them to go where they want, is the backpack like zapping their nervous system to like tell them to go like left or right? Like how,
yeah, I'm basically so,
like Pickle Rick, like that's what I'm picturing.
Don't want to go that way.
Yeah. So basically I mean, obviously this is an audio format, so I don't know that I can show a picture, but basically like they kind of like hook the antenna into the backpack. And then also the backpack kind of attaches to their cerci too, which are on the back end of the cockroach. Those two little pointy bits on the back end of a cockroach. So both of those are very important sensory organs for cockroaches. So they can kind of, and they're super sensitive. So I don't even know if it's just zapping as to like, maybe like little vibrations almost that They didn't really go into details on like how that part worked. But yeah, it was just wild to see like the little antenna like tucked in into the backpack.
Yeah. That makes a lot of sense. Okay, that's really cool.
Yeah, no, it was super cool. As soon as I saw that picture of the cockroaches in the backpacks, I was like, and this is my paper for the podcast.
We definitely need a picture for that to include in our post online when we post on our pestology blog with this.
It's already in there. It's locked and loaded. Awesome. Well, I think if Jen doesn't have any other questions, I think Mike was going to go next. After a very serious rock, paper, scissors tournament that happened in the office.
Yeah, that's how we resolve any dispute in the technical team. All decisions are made via rock, paper, scissors. So I am going second here. And so we self-time, but we also police each other. So we'll make sure here. I've got my timer out. I tend to go long, so I want to make sure I don't screw this up too much here. And our timer starts after we finish the title, because sometimes the titles are long. This one's not a really long one, though. But this is a paper that was recently published in March 13th, 2024, out of Environmental Entomology. Number of different authors on the paper. So I'm not going to go through and read everybody's names, but it's... Zeta et al. So that's for folks that are looking for that. We do provide a link to all these papers afterwards. And the title of the paper is Distinct Communities Under the Snow, Describing Characteristics of Subnivium Arthropod Communities. Word of the day, subnivium. Had to look that up. All right. Common misconception is that arthropod life simply dies off or just disappears in the colder months. And that couldn't be farther from the truth. In reality, we know that arthropod life continues to survive in one capacity or another all year round, thanks to a pretty cool list of ways that insects and other arthropods can survive sub-freezing temperatures. Many organisms can produce things like antifreeze-like substances that prevent cells from freezing, while others may simply look for various methods of cold avoidance, such as finding a warm home to nestle up into for the winter to survive. Now, a lot of arthropods may use actually a combination of both of these strategies, the antifreeze-like substances to keep bodies from freezing when exposed to unfavorable conditions, while also looking for a nice protective environment to hide into, such as leaf litter or even under the snow. Now, surprisingly, snow can act as an excellent insulator and provide a blanket of protection underneath, specifically when the snowpack reaches about 15 to 20 centimeters. It can create a stable environment below that remains relatively warm in comparison to the ambient air above that also protects that environment and that layer from freezing wind and other unfavorable conditions. Now, this protective region is generally known as the subnivium, which I did not know of until I read this paper, and can serve as a winter refuge for a long list of organisms. So subnivium, Ellie probably knows this, Latin basically just means under the snow. Right, which brings us to this paper. So the authors wanted to look at and evaluate what the arthropod community would look like underneath the snow, and most importantly, compare what that community diversity could be to summer collections. So what they did was they set up a site in northern New Hampshire. They used pitfall traps to surveil arthropod communities. They looked at overall community composition, so what different species were out there, the range of different species, the total collection size, and overall diversity. And whenever I say pitfall traps, these are special collection devices that are just as the name sounds. They set up these small, they dig little holes, they put these little cups in there, and things will just wander up and fall into those. Sometimes they bait them with certain things. In this case, these were just simply cups that were set out to passively collect anything that may accidentally fall into it. They set up collections over two winters and one summer. In total, they collected over 20,000 different arthropods, or total arthropods, sorry. The heavy hitters were things like you would typically find in leaf litter, stuff like Calimbula, mites, spiders, rove beetles, and other coleoptera, millipedes, and centipedes. They did find, not surprisingly, that summer collections recorded about six times more arthropods than winter collections. So kind of expected to see a higher abundance diversity overall from summer versus winter. The insects, in terms of abundance, insects accounted for roughly 18% of the total collection in the winter and about one quarter of all things collected in the summer. But 95% of everything collected were adults. Again, not necessarily surprising, but again, one of the big takeaways here was that while winter months differed from summer months in terms of communities and collections, subnuvium collections, so sub-snow collections, tended to be lower in both abundance and diversity. Specifically, the snowpack community was much lower in overall abundance and biomass, meaning that the wide range of stuff that they were catching was much smaller in the winter. But what was really cool was that they found that there were a few things they were collecting only in the winter months. About 37% of the species that they were collected were only collected in the winter, meaning that they were finding some of these species were specialists that specifically survived in this environment. Now, this paper is not the only paper of its kind. The subnuvium region has been investigated in similar ways, shapes, and forms in the past. But this paper and others like it demonstrate that life just simply does not pause during the winter. It continues on in a number of different ways. Now, there's a wide range of diverse and distinct communities of arthropods out there that have evolved these specialist ways that evolved as specialists to survive and not only survive, but thrive in some of these sub-freezing communities. Now, in terms of what this means for pest control, this is just more evidence to show that arthropod activity continues to remain active in the winter months, even in those heavy snowfall days. In fact, I would argue that on heavy snowfall days, you may even actually be providing more protection for some of these communities. And while we don't see a lot of our typical heavy hitters on this species list for what they were recovering, things like ticks, it is important to note that there is a thing called trap bias. So the way in which these insects and other arthropods were being trapped may not be the best way to sample for other pests. Overall, it was a really cool study, definitely added to our knowledge and understanding of what these winter communities may look like. And I would certainly be curious to see and learn more about the changes in sampling methods if that were to change up different species and arthropod groups that we find. And given these communities rely on about 15 to 20 centimeters of snow to provide that effective layer of protection, how declining snowfall, which is a trend we're currently seeing, may impact seasonal survival rates of other pests over time.
A little bit over time there.
It may have gone over a little bit. May have stopped reading the script and just went off key for a little bit.
Vibes.
Okay, my turn. Ask questions.
Yeah.
Should I say where they were testing, where there was snow, layers of snow in the summertime? Or is that like, was that artificial?
And I should have clarified. So it was, they were comparing basically what the arthropod community would look like in the winter when there was snow versus summer when there was no snow. It is northern New Hampshire. I know that that area stays very cold. I know you're probably used to some pretty late snowy conditions, even into the later months from where you originally hail from. But yeah, the sample sites, there was no snow in the summer. It was warmer days. So they were looking at how that would affect the arthropod community.
Okay. And so if the arthropods fell into this trap, right, for monitoring, what happened, like, did they live in the trap for observation, or like we just noted what kind of species we were dealing with and then?
Yeah. So pitfall traps are just simply a passive way to collect and survey the stuff that's out there. So they literally dig a hole, drop a slick cup down in there or some other device that may have substance on the side of it so things can't crawl back out. And the idea is that it's a way to passively collect things that may just be wandering by and accidentally find their way into that trap. So usually trap numbers are pretty low, but it's a great way to kind of figure out what is just casually in that environment. So it's a total of 32 different pitfall traps over a few different sites for these collections. So they usually have to use a high number of traps to be able to get a meaningful number.
But also, almost every entomologist has a horror story about a pitfall trap of some kind.
I'm thinking like bed bug, you know, the bed bug traps where they fall in.
It's very similar. It's the same kind of design. So a lot of times, you know, depending on what you're looking for, I mentioned that there's trap bias with these things. Dung beetles are a very common species or group of insects to survey. And you have to bait these traps.
One time I was doing a pitfall trap study and we had a mouse fall in and not able to get out. And then we just had a bunch of carrion beetles in there because they were attracted by the rotting mouse carcass.
Oh my gosh. That's funny.
Again, maybe it's just me, but I'm like, every entomologist has a horror story about pitfall traps.
Right.
Well, it makes sense, right? Because, I mean, if you think about like igloos, or I mean, plenty of mammals that are using, you know, tunnels under the snow and things like that. So it makes sense. Yeah. There's, and I remember, so we had like, I guess it was 2 years ago now, a huge snowstorm. And so when it was sunny and warm and we were out playing in the snow, there was so many active flies and even mosquitoes, and I was shocked. And so maybe that's where they were. They were hiding underneath and then they emerged to play with us.
Yeah, I mean, it's entirely like it. That's why I said, I mean, this was one very distinct sampling method. There's a lot of other ways to sample stuff out there. And this is, it's just one of those cool studies that, you know, we assume and we know that things survive through the winter and things survive in different ways. This is a really cool look into one unique way in which an entire community of arthropods can survive this. And just because it's winter does not mean pest activity or arthropod activity just stops. So,
amen.
Yeah. Okay.
Mike, did they say how long the study was for? Was it just for the 1 year or was it multiple years?
2 winters and 1 summer.
Okay.
So, yeah. So, 1.5-ish.
Okay.
Cool.
All right. Ellie, you ready?
All righty. So, those were both great papers. So, quite a bit to follow up here with. But the paper that I chose for today, this was from, this is Zanola et al. And it was in Communications Biology, published in January of this year. And these studies were done at the University of Buenos Aires in Argentina and collabed with University of Regensburg in Germany. So the title of my paper is Ants Evade Harmful Food by Active Abandonment. So this article was looking at the Argentine ant. They were in Argentina, which is actually where they're native to. And they're invasive in the US and a lot of other parts of the world. But the idea was to look at if these ants are actually abandoning toxic baits. So the researchers created a sugar solution that they knew the ants liked, and a toxic solution that used boric acid as the active ingredient, which is something that is used in a lot of ant baits. And it was added to that sugar solution as well. Now, they know that mortality was delayed for this toxic solution, which is critical for ant baiting. So the ant actually makes it back to the colony. And they made sure that the ants lived for at least 6 hours after consumption, so it wasn't going to mess with the study. And they also confirmed that the bait was still palatable to the ants, so they would avoid the possibility of just discovering that they didn't like the taste versus they actually were abandoning it. So there's two main experiments that they ran. The first was day scale dynamics and extent of trail abandonment. And the second was hour scale. So two different time scales. And for both of these, what they did is they started out by luring the ants into a false sense of security by providing a sugar-only solution that was not toxic over a bridge to a set of feeders. We'll post a photo of this on Pestology, but it's basically like a ramp going up to a balance beam, and the feeder is at the end of the balance beam. So the ants have to go there and they have to trail up there, which worked out well because then the researchers could count how many ants per minute were going towards that, as well as what we call the trunk trail, which is the trail of ants that are going to the nest. That's not necessarily related to where the food is. And so that first experiment, they had two of these bridge setups, 7 meters apart from each other along the trunk trail. And after they got them acclimated, they got the baseline activity, and then they swapped out one of those for the toxic bait. So they had a regular and the toxic one, and they did measurements every hour for 2 hours initially, and then they continued doing that for a couple more days in afternoons and mornings to get the average activities during what would be more active times for the ants. And they did that whole thing 5 times on different trunk trails for repetitions. And that showed that trail abandonment did occur pretty quickly. Within 18 hours of that toxic bait being provided, the ants started avoiding it or abandoning it. But they were still going for the sugar solution, and there were still ants on the trunk trail, which means that there weren't just less ants because they were being killed off. They were actually choosing to not go to the toxic bait. And then based off of that, they looked at a closer time scale because they had only been doing these measurements twice a day. And were like, okay, so maybe this is happening even quicker. And that's what they found. So they looked at this. They did the experiment again, looking every hour from like 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. instead of just twice a day. And they found that the abandonment started at 43% reduction in ants per minute within 3 hours. And at 6 hours, they had a 79% reduction in ants going towards that bait, which is a huge reduction. Again, the regular sugar bridge didn't have any decrease, and the trunk trail didn't have any decrease either. So with all that said, and what they found was that the ants were not being satiated, they were not being killed, and they continued actively foraging throughout the experiment, and specifically were abandoning the toxic bait that was still known to be palatable, but also wasn't killing them off. So how does that impact our control tactics? So basically what that means is that 3-hour time frame that we know that abandonment starts, that means that the initial placement of baits is super critical. So getting that bait placement right the first time to maximize how many ants are going to go to it before they start abandoning it. And also this means that palatability is different than abandonment. So there are some other ant baits that studies have found not to be as effective, but they might need to be looked at again and maybe just made to be more tasty, because what may have been happening was not actual abandonment and the baits not being useful, just they might not have liked the taste. So it has a lot of implications for improvements to products for ant baiting and ant control.
Very cool. Do you know, so, I mean, obviously the study was out of Argentina, so maybe that's why they picked the Argentina ants, but is that like, are all ants' palates the same or at least similar? So we can assume that like a moisture ant or a carpenter ant or something might have the same.
Yeah. So depending on the species of ant you have, they can have different preferences. Also times of the year and what like dietary needs the ants have, whether going towards like carbohydrate based or protein based baits, that can change. However, I think the idea of like somehow the ants picking up the fact that it was a toxic bait, whether it just made their tummies grumbly or whether they were somehow tasting the difference in it, is it's hard to tell. And that's one of the things they'd need to like study more to be able to figure out. So not exactly sure if all other types of ants would exhibit the same behavior too, just because this was only done on Argentine ants, but it opens up the idea for study on other species of ants as well to see if that behavior is consistent. Given that all the ants are social insects, you know, there is kind of the assumption that this probably is the case with some other ants, but we can't say for sure.
And so in this case, tell me, because I'm not the technical director here. Gel baits, for example, mm-hmm. They take those back, right? And so then they can just redistribute. But in this situation, it sounds like they are eating or consuming. They're not bringing anything back. Is that right?
So sort of. So ants, they can only... adult ants can only consume liquids, and when they consume it, they store it, and then when they because they have to put it somewhere, and then when they bring it back to the colony, they regurgitate that to the immatures of the colony or to other ants. So if they have a liquid bait, they are still bringing that back, even if the ant was in a lab study and didn't regurgitate that back out, they still like survived. But the idea is that the toxicity of what they're consuming is going to be given to the other ants.
Diluted. So it's not like officially being consumed. So it's not secondary consumption. It's still like primary.
It's still the same. Yeah, it's still the same stuff that's been sitting inside the ant being given back to the colony. The adults do, you know, digest some of it because they've got to live off of something too if it's liquid. If it's a solid food, though, they can't digest that. And then they have to get fed back from the immatures that can digest the solid foods. Ant eating is weird.
Yeah, I didn't know that about adults.
It's really weird.
And Ellie, did you say that they only looked at borate-based baits?
So they looked at the boric acid as the active ingredient, yes. So that was the only active ingredient they did in this study. But of course, it does invite the possibility of the same kind of study with other active ingredients.
Yeah, so it would be interesting to see, because based on what we do know about how borates affect organisms and its mode of action, it would be interesting to see how other active ingredients and different chemical classes would affect ants, maybe if they would be similar or different. That's really cool. I never really thought about that being a potential factor before.
It is really
declining visits to bait are just because the colony is declining because the bait's working. But
so not the active ingredient is why it wasn't successful. But
they made a whole point is that there's other studies that show, they call it like avoidance behavior, but they specifically are saying in this experiment they're calling it abandonment, because avoidance behavior is implying the ants are like learning to avoid something, but it's the first time they had been exposed to this toxin before. They couldn't possibly know that it was, because abandonment happened in just a few hours before anything would have died. So they couldn't know that it was toxic by like seeing other ants die off or seeing direct effects. They must somehow, like I said, feel that there's some ill effects, or there's, I don't know, there's something else going on there that's ticking them off.
Well, and to your point, there are things that they crave based on what they need in terms of nutrition. So if there's nothing of nutrients in there,
it's mixed in with the sugar solution. So that's what made it like appealing. And with all the baits you need, you need something in there that's going to actually be desirable to them for sure.
Did they say like how many colonies they tested this with? Because it feels like, you know, sometimes different ant colonies have different personalities about them. So some of them might be a little bit more bait shy than others, you know?
Yeah. So they talked about for the day-wise scale, they did 5 different trunk trails. So from what I got, that was meaning like 5 different colonies. And then the hour-wise scale, they did that on 6 other colonies. So there was a bunch of different ones. And like, it wasn't super clear that there were different colonies when they say different trunk trails, but I would assume that spatially they would be far enough apart.
Well, if there was an award for most questions asked on a paper, I think, Ellie, you would get it.
That's it was really a really funky paper.
Yeah. Now I want them to do the same thing with other active ingredients to see how that compares.
Yeah, I mean, this was like huge when I saw this, because I mean, I think the big implications are like things that we thought weren't working with ants, but maybe they just didn't like the taste of it. And there's things you can do to make, you know, synergists or other things you can do to make a bait more tasty and kind of disguise the active ingredient. It seemed like they were kind of talking about there are some chemical things you could do there.
When using a borate-based bait.
So when using a borate-based bait, I can't remember specifically if they mentioned that was possible for other active ingredients as well. They were saying that, you know, this same study would need to be done with other active ingredients to tell if like that would be applicable.
Sorry for all the questions, everybody. I'm an ant guy, so this is like particularly interesting to me. Jen's like, this is too much. We need to stop.
No, I was engaged. I thought it was very interesting too. And I didn't know, like Laura made the comment that each colony has its own like personality. And it kind of made me picture like, have y'all done, you know, like those reality, like they've typically done them with like the gophers or the, you know, they show the family of and follow them along and put voices to them. Y'all should have like ant colonies that you kind of maybe voice over of like interpretation.
Oh, that could be fun.
We need to put it in the budget to get an ant colony to have in our bug zoo at work.
Yeah, I had at one point, I have a giant ant farm that hangs on the wall that I had harvested.
Oh, yeah.
But they all died off, and then I forgot.
They're hard to keep alive. We tried to do the ant farm thing, and
Yeah, it's so funny. I mean, it never ceases to amaze me that you could have an infestation of insert pest here inside of a house, and there's nothing that kills it. It survives a nuclear holocaust, right? Like, or a nuclear apocalypse. But then you go through and try to keep something alive in like a small container, and it just the slightest whim, like a stiff breeze, kills it. Very annoying.
Can't put nature in a box.
That's right. All right. Well, three papers, three presentations, three different conclusions. Our work is done.
Yeah.
Time for the hard part, Jen.
Okay. And you don't want me to share my like reasoning here, right? You just want me to
you can elaborate as much as you want on the winner. But I don't need to know why I came in third place. Let's just put it that way. All right.
Okay. So.
There's no Academy medals here. For second, third.
We're competitive, but we don't even get a medal.
Should have sent them ahead of time and then had like somebody walk up to each of your offices with your medals. Okay. So I felt like, oh man, that's tough. Laura, I feel like you were really excited and kind of passionate about the entertainment part of the story. And so I really, you'll probably, I guess you're going to take the win. But Ellie, I had a lot of questions. I felt like yours was most relevant to our industry and how to, you know, make certain improvements and kind of watch how that research can develop for the betterment of our products. So I really appreciated hearing that. And then, you know, what would we do if we didn't know what Subrivium, is that the right word? Did I say it right?
Subrivium.
Subrivium. Anyways. Okay. I
feel like
there you go.
I wasn't prepared to have to say it again. I already closed the document.
What would we have done if we never learned the meaning of that? anyways,
the SAT word of the day.
All of those are great. I guess I'm going to give it to Laura for the entertainment of like the visualization of the cockroach with the backpack and the all of that. probably like Ellie, you did a great job and took it home with how to apply it to the industry. Oh, there's a crown.
There's a crown.
Okay.
We need to add in a cyborg cockroach to the top of it now.
Yeah. Oh,
I would love that.
I got my little plastic one here.
That would be great. Yeah. We got some hot glue around this office somewhere. We'll make it happen.
We ended up with a bunch of those from Legislative Day in our luggage. I'm sure it freaked some people out. And then like we traveled from Legislative Day to Montana and like a few places. And so the little bugs have just been left places and I won't get to see the reactions.
Oh, that's great.
I had to laugh though when Ellie was like, well, we're not going to say who won what. And I could see the crown in the background. I was like, oh no.
I know. I was like, oh boy, everybody's going to get something, right? Well, good job, guys. Those are all interesting stories. I appreciate getting to be a part of that.
Yeah. Thank you for being our judge. I mean, we're always on this end of it. So we, you know, we're sweating while we're giving our papers, but then we put it all on you and you did a great job analyzing everything.
Well, thanks.
Yeah, you definitely have the heaviest lift of all of us. So really appreciate you agreeing to do this. So
it was fun.
Awesome. Well, I think we've subjected you to enough. We will release you now and let you leave the nerd kingdom so you can get back to normal life and not have to listen to any more bug facts.
Hey, I was honored to be a part of it and I'm happy to nerd out anytime.
Well, awesome. Well, thanks so much, Jen. We really appreciate you being on. Thanks for everything you do for the industry.
Yeah, thank you all so much.
All right, take care. All right, everybody. Well, that's a wrap for another episode of MPMA's Bug Bites.
If you're interested in hearing more about any of the research we cover on the podcast, be sure to check out our pestology blog. You can find the blog at npmapestology.com, and we'll also have a link in the description of this podcast.
And be sure to like and rate the podcast, leave feedback if you have any, and subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss the release of a new episode. Thanks for listening.
MPMA Bug Bites is the industry source for the latest in science news and pest control research. It's brought to you by the National Pest Management Association. You can find links to the science discussed in this episode, as well as technical and business resources, training opportunities, and information about careers in pest control by visiting mpmapestworld.org.